It's Friday, February 5th. Republicans wouldn't do it, so Democrats did. We start here. In an unprecedented vote, Congress decides to kick a sitting member off her committee assignments.
I never once said during my entire campaign, QAnon.
Why even outraged GOP leaders refused to go there. The president's got a message for the world.
America is back.
But the Biden doctrine might have challenges up front. And would you invite 10,000 people from all over the world to your city right now?
You have to avoid pretty much all public spaces, restaurants, public transportation, stores.
The flame is still alive, for now, how Olympic officials are preparing in Tokyo. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. Not many topics require an emergency meeting with every Republican member of the House. Almost none of those topics keep that meeting going for 5 hours. Well, that was the level of urgency that overtook the Capitol this week as lawmakers learned what their colleague Marjorie Taylor Greene had said in her not-so-recent past.
The freshman lawmaker has been under fire for questioning the 9/11 attacks.
Greene has also embraced the QAnon conspiracy theory.
She has also suggested that the Sandy Hook and Parkland school shootings were staged.
And you can almost feel Republicans begging Greene to make this easier on them. Because on one hand, this is not build that wall level rhetoric we're talking about. In some cases, this is a member of Congress telling voters there are Democrats among them that deserve the death penalty.
It's a crime punishable by death is what treason is. Nancy Pelosi is guilty of treason.
And this person has been named to the Education and Labor Committees. And yet these Republicans also did not want to be seen smacking down a member of their own party. Well, Marjorie Taylor Greene did not necessarily make this easy.
She did tweet today that she thinks the reason this is happening to her is because she's, quote, white woman, wife, mother, Christian, conservative, business owner. These are the reasons they don't want me on education and labor.
So she did not step down on her own. Party leaders said she apologized for her comments in private, but she wouldn't do so in public. The GOP nevertheless decided to keep her in place, essentially telling Democrats, if you want her off these committees, you do it.
If we are now going to start judging what other members have said before they're even members of Congress, I think it's going to be a hard time for the Democrats to place anybody on committee.
And so last night, in an unprecedented vote, the House considered whether to demote a member of Congress who is still incredibly popular in deep red constituencies. Let's go to ABC's congressional correspondent, Rachel Scott. Rachel, can you just walk me through this vote last night and how this all went down?
Yeah, well, so as the House was preparing to take action against her, Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene unexpectedly took to the floor to defend her reputation.
What you need to know about me is I'm a very regular American, just like the people I represent in my district and most people across the country.
She walked out onto the House floor with the words free speech printed in bold letters on her mask, and she started to express some remorse, saying that she regrets some of her past comments.
You see, school shootings are absolutely real. I also want to tell you 9/11 absolutely happened. So later in 2018, when I started finding misinformation, lies, things that were not true in these QAnon posts, I stopped believing it.
But what she did not do was apologize for anything that she has said.
I never once said during my entire campaign, QAnon. I never once said any of the things that I am being accused of today during my campaign. I never said any of these things since I have been elected for Congress.
And it's notable that she's coming forward amid this political pressure, that she's buckling and expressing regret. But for Democrats, they say this is too little too late.
The point here is that she has promoted and advocated violence.
This is about a member stalking the children of tragedy.
Someone who 3 days ago called her critics pedophiles.
This is about whether it is okay to hold an assault rifle next to members' heads in a campaign ad and incite death threats against them.
For Democrats here, they said this was about sending a message, especially after the violence that we saw play out on Capitol Hill on January 6th. They wanted to send a message that this violent rhetoric will not be tolerated.
In 2019, during the same election cycle in which she ran, showed support for comments online that the quickest way to remove Speaker Pelosi from power would be, and I quote, a bullet to the head. Did any of you hear Steve King say anything like that? You removed him from all of his committees.
Well, then this went to a vote and it passed.
The yeas are 230 and the nays are 199.
11 Republicans voting with Democrats to strip her from those committees.
And can we talk about the Republicans here, Rachel? Because Democrats could have done this on their own, and this was an unprecedented vote for the party in charge to tell the minority party what to do with their committee assignments. But what about these Republicans? What went into this decision?
Well, Brad, normally this is handled in party leadership. It would be up to Democrats or Republicans to remove a member of their own party from a certain committee if they wanted to. But Republicans did absolutely nothing here.
We denounce anything that we've seen that was said in that past, from anything with QAnon has no place in our party. And Marjorie Greene actually said that inside our conference today. She said it before, but she said from the shootings and everywhere else. And if that gave people problems, she's a small business owner. So we'd say budget and small business. I was more than willing to do that. The conference was willing to do that. And Steny Hoyer and the Democrats said no.
But this was a bipartisan vote. We saw 11 Republicans vote with Democrats in order to strip Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene from those committee assignments. But one name that we did not see was Congresswoman Liz Cheney.
The number three Republican in the House, Liz Cheney, announcing she'll vote to impeach, saying there has never been a greater betrayal by a president of the United States of his office and his oath to the Constitution.
She decided to vote against this. She clinched on to her leadership title after she was experiencing extreme backlash for voting to impeach.
We need to go forward together, and that we need to go forward in a way that helps us beat back the really dangerous and negative Democrat policies.
She says that this sets a dangerous precedent for the institution and that Democrats may regret this when Republicans regain the majority, a very strong warning to her colleagues across the aisle, Brad.
Right, yes, she basically said, like, Republicans should be the ones handling this, to which Democrats said, well, you didn't handle anything. In the meantime, this very divided Congress, some Republicans that actually voted to remove Greene last night were from Florida communities that saw the effects of the mass shooting she once seemed to question even happened. And these questions about rhetoric get even bigger as we head into the trial of President Trump next week. Thanks, Rachel.
Thanks, Brad.
So long as our relationship is defined by our differences, we will empower those who sow hatred rather than peace.
You might remember when Barack Obama began his term, he decided to give a major foreign policy speech in Cairo. After years of the Bush administration, he kind of wanted this reset with the Muslim world. Well, following Donald Trump,
it's going to be only America first. America first.
President Biden seemed to want a reset as well, but his foreign policy problems might even begin closer to home.
America is back. Diplomacy is back.
So yesterday, President Biden made a quick trip over to the State Department to speak to diplomats themselves, which means ABC's Connor Finnegan just had to pop downstairs. He works the State Department beat. Connor, what was the message here?
Brent, I think the message Thursday was pretty clear. It was not just, you know, we'll have your backs and diplomacy is back, a line that the president has used again and again. But he said to these diplomats that they will be entrusted
and
empowered
to do your job. But I ask each of you to abide by a few core tenets. Integrity in all you do.
I was in the room and he was pretty emphatic in that moment. You know, we're a little over 2 weeks into Biden's term, and the fact that he made this visit so early and it's his first visit to a federal agency, I think really sends a strong signal to the diplomatic corps.
You are the center of all that I intend to do. You are the heart of it.
But I think the problem for the Biden administration is that it's going to take a lot more than just cheerleading and slogans to really build that trust and really build back the morale at the agency. It really has been a tough 4 years for the State Department.
Or as they call it, the Deep State Department. You don't mind.
You know, there was real retaliation against career folks.
Yovanovitch, who testified in the impeachment inquiry, says she was ousted by the Trump administration as part of a smear campaign.
We need a vigorous Department of State. But right now, the State Department is in trouble.
There are watchdog reports about other Trump appointees harassing and abusing career folks in their offices. And they were also sidelined.
Kushner making the long trip to Iraq even before the president's own Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson.
I promise you I'm going to have your back. I promise you. And I expect you to have the back of the American people.
Okay, so if you're saying then, like, there's a culture issue at state, but it goes beyond culture, like, you've got actual things you're going to have to deal with, what is going to be the top of Biden's and the new Secretary Blinken's list?
Biden laid that out pretty clearly. You know, there are certain things that he mentioned in what was otherwise more of a foreign policy vision speech.
Defending freedom, championing opportunity, upholding universal rights, respecting the rule of law, and treating every person with dignity.
He promised a much tougher line on China.
American leadership must meet this new moment of advancing authoritarianism, including the growing ambitions of China to rival the United States and the determination of Russia to damage and disrupt our democracy.
And he said something that he said repeatedly on the campaign trail, that he would repair America's place in the world. He's returning the U.S. to the Paris Climate Agreement. He's halting the exit from the World Health Organization. He's showing up again at these different U.N. bodies.
We're ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales.
And he's doing what he says is repairing U.S. alliances.
And leading with diplomacy means standing shoulder to shoulder with our allies and key partners once again.
You know, President Trump and his administration officials will tell you that they expanded the map of alliances. They helped forge new ties between Israel and Arab partners. But Trump also bashed key treaty allies. He haggled with Japan and South Korea over how much they paid for U.S. troops. And President Biden says he'll work with these countries to take on larger challenges like China.
And our administration is ready to take up the mantle and lead once again.
But it's interesting, Brad, because there are a couple of issues here that are quickly becoming crises for the Biden administration that the president didn't even mention. Iran really comes to top of mind for me because his State Department warned just this week that it requires urgency, that the nuclear threat from Iran is expanding.
Iran is out of compliance on a number of fronts, and it would take some time, should it make the decision to do so, for it to come back into compliance, and time for us then to assess whether it was meeting its obligations. So we're not there yet, to say the least.
Obviously, the other key challenge is North Korea, which has a growing nuclear weapons arsenal and has clearly signaled that it is not interested in talks. It is not interested in getting rid of that nuclear blanket.
Well, and so it sounds like these are big sprawling objectives that the Biden administration has. We talked yesterday on the show, Connor, about how, like, within DHS, immigration policy, you can change it if you want, like that, right? Like, refugees, bringing in more of them, the wall, we're stopping building it. Can you do that with other countries when you're talking about they've got their own leaders, their own militaries, their own treaties that they're part of?
No, and you know what, Brad? That's sort of the key problem for the United States government at this point, and it's one of the things that Biden tried to highlight in his speech yesterday.
Investing in our diplomacy isn't something we do just because it's the right thing to do for the world. We do it in order to live in peace, security, and prosperity. We do it because it's in our own naked self-interest.
The U.S. has to be consistent on the world stage. Otherwise, its word is undermined.
This was a horrible, one-sided deal that should have never, ever been made.
The fact that the Obama administration entered an agreement with Iran and other world powers to limit its nuclear program, and then Trump does a 180, reimposes sanctions, pulls out of the deal, only for the Biden administration to come in and now say that they're interested in re-entering the agreement.
Oh, right, like Iran's going like, sure, yes, we believe you for sure.
But the rest of the world is saying the same thing. And the problem is that undermines America's word on the world stage. And so what Biden administration officials like Jake Sullivan, his national security advisor, have said is that they want to create a consistent foreign policy that is really grounded in the American public's interests. That's become even more real, perhaps than ever before with the pandemic. And so what they want to do is convince the American people that these policies are serving them not only at home, but around the world.
Right. Things here obviously impact us at home. Things abroad also impact us at home. It's tougher, though, to make the argument sometimes to voters, considering it can take years for these issues to kind of unwind and come back to us. All right. Connor Finnegan and Foggy Bottom at the State Department. Thank you.
Thanks, Brett.
Next time on Start Here, faster, higher, safer, the new Olympic playbook after the break.
Well,
Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miroboard. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miroboard?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt the cartridge.
What were you thinking at that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia. Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.
So at this point, the concern about COVID-19 variants from places like the UK and Brazil and South Africa, the concern is so great that a full year into this pandemic, countries are radically shifting how they deal with travelers. In fact, just yesterday, the UK declared that starting later this month, if you enter the country from somewhere else, you must go to a so-called quarantine hotel. None of this, hey, you know, please, like, don't mix with large crowds, guys. No, you'll go to a hotel where you're literally not allowed to contact others for 2 weeks. It seems obvious at this point that 2021 is not going to look that different from 2020, at least not for the next several months. So if you're the city of Tokyo, how do you feel about inviting thousands and thousands of athletes from all over the world?
It is global news of consequence. The announcement has been made this morning that the 2020 Olympic Games, scheduled for late July into early August of this year in Tokyo, will be postponed for a year.
That's right. In case you'd forgotten, the Olympics are still scheduled for this summer. And because it's such a huge event, they basically got to decide right now, are we doing this or not? Joining us now is Darcy Main from our partners at ESPN. She's been reporting on how the Olympics can possibly happen in the era of COVID. Darcy, thanks for being with us. Are these games still happening or what?
You know, just the way you phrase it right there, it sounds so daunting. Maybe not. The reality is right now, it certainly seems like the IOC and the country of Japan full steam ahead.
There are indeed a lot of questions in the public domain about how the games will take place this summer. And today is a preliminary view on how things will be done.
They released a playbook earlier this week with all of the various protocols. So some interesting things were in there. There had been a lot of talk about vaccines. Would they be required for athletes to enter Japan to participate in the games? A lot of kind of ethical questions about that. Should elite athletes trump other people in line in terms of getting vaccines right now?
We are not in favor of athletes jumping the queue. This we said already in November last year.
And the World Health Organization weighed in on that recently. They said, duh, absolutely not.
In the playbook, we are documenting what will be the typical journey.
Of course, testing, big deal. You have to get tested within 72 hours of your first flight. Obviously, you have to produce a negative test.
And in the athlete village, they're being told to keep apart.
And you have to avoid pretty much all public spaces. Restaurants, public transportation, stores, touristy areas.
That means a ban on intimacy. Yes, it's being viewed as a sex ban at these Olympics. The stadiums will look very different as well. They will sound very different because those in them are being urged not to sing and chant, but only to clap.
Athletes, of course, then are not going to be able to go to watch other competitions in other venues during that 14-day period. And of course, that's a radically different experience that they are used to as athletes. I think that's one of the things people really love and enjoy is getting to watch other people and in sports that they're not familiar with even. So it's just going to be a very different experience for athletes.
But so, Darcy, just so I'm clear, though, just within the competition themselves, like say there's a wrestling team with 20 guys on it. There's five coaches. There's like three trainers. I don't know if any of them like bring their family. If one person gets sick, like does the team, like they're all together all the time. Does the team just have to quit or like do they redo the competition? Like what do you do?
That's one of those things that I don't think we have a clear answer for at this point. Obviously, there's going to be a ton of contact tracing. They do talk about that. If someone on a team tests positive and they've been training every day together, it feels hard to believe that then they'd let the rest of the team continue. But I think that's one of those things. They are going to release further details in another playbook or another version of the playbook in April. So I think that's one of those things we might get a little bit more clarity on at that point, or at least I hope so.
And we keep talking as if athletes are surely going to go, like there will be thousands of athletes there. But are there ones that are hesitant about traveling like this during a pandemic?
Yeah, I mean, the reality is, I think we all think of Olympic athletes as the ones that win the gold medal or the gymnasts that sort of like become the darlings of the world or the Michael Phelps of the world or the track stars, the Usain Bolts. But the average Olympian, the overwhelming majority of Olympians are not those people. Most of them have other jobs and they have other dreams. And some of them are putting off med school or starting a family or all sorts of other things. And I think for a lot of people, it's been, why am I going to continue doing this?
I am overwhelmed just with satisfaction that finally a decision was made. I mean, I don't think people like were really understanding, like, we're stubborn. We're stubborn athletes here. We're driven.
And the constant uncertainty has got to be so hard to deal with. And you really ramp up your training going into an Olympic year.
And we're curious, what have you been doing to keep yourself busy in this quarantine time?
We're definitely deep cleaning the house a lot. And, you know, since all the pools are closed, I can't be swimming right now. But doing a lot of ab workouts.
I think this is really challenging for the overwhelming majority of them of, is it worth it?
Repeated opinion polls in Japan showing the vast majority of Japanese, up to 80%, don't want the games to proceed. They're in their third lockdown because of a wave of infections. But Thomas Bach was insistent that the games were going ahead. He said,
of course, what this really comes down to in a lot of ways is money, as a lot of things do. But in this case, I mean, there are billions and billions of dollars invested. I think the last figure I saw was Japan's already spent over $15 billion. The broadcast rights alone are worth somewhere in the neighborhood of $2 to $3 billion. So even if fans aren't allowed, and that's something they haven't decided yet, they will soon, even if they are not allowed, that is a ton of money we're talking about that you can understand why they would do everything in their power to make this work.
And if we would think the games could not be safe, we would not go for it.
So as of now, it looks like July 23rd, all systems go. It looks like Japan wants the Olympic Games to happen. And as of now, it actually looks like it's going to happen.
Which means all systems go for the journalists like you that are covering it. All right. Darcy Main from our partners at ESPN. Thank you.
Thank you.
How did you react when you learned that there was a different standard being used for Black players to get benefits as compared to white players?
I felt so betrayed, and I still feel that way. Two different systems? How can that be okay? Why should that be okay?
You know, ever since ABC News posted its investigative reporting this week on the NFL and why its concussion settlement program uses the set of protocols known as race norming as part of the evaluation of head trauma cases, we've gotten a ton of reaction. And some of the reactions that have struck me are experts who say, yeah, this is not a new concept. There is a weird, complicated history to all this.
Race correction, the automatic categorical adjustment of
diagnoses based on race alone is extremely common in medicine.
That's Dorothy Roberts from the University of Pennsylvania, who's actually been researching the history of race in medicine for years.
Of course, today doctors will say they're adjusting for race to account for real biological differences in order to treat people of different races better.
I should say, there's also a theory in cognitive tests that you need race norming because the test itself can be biased. Like, if someone asks me an IQ question about a boat, but I've never been around boats before, well, that social difference might make me score more poorly. But Roberts says the fact that scientists will parse data, sometimes explicitly to highlight differences between races, well, that draws a troubling line way back in American history.
This idea, though, goes back to the slavery era. It goes back to the idea that black people were suited to be enslaved. In fact, the idea that they were healthier under white people's control.
And it made us wonder, what other moments throughout American history are still molding how we're living today? Well, throughout Black History Month, we're going to try something new. We've invited a series of contributors from around ABC News to take the mic and describe in their own words what moments and trends have shaped who we are and where we're going. One of those areas that defines American culture, as we've seen, is sports. And so today, we asked LZ Granderson to give his take on how race and sports have intersected in his eyes to affect the black experience. LZ is a sports writer, a culture columnist, and an ABC News contributor. So we asked him to do kind of an opinion column, an audio essay. Here it is now.
And one last thing. On the day former NBA Commissioner David Stern died, Magic Johnson posted something on Twitter that I would never forget.
Because of the HIV virus that I have attained, I will have to retire from the Lakers today.
He wrote in part, "When I announced I had HIV, people thought they can get the virus from shaking my hand. When David allowed me to play in the 1992 All-Star Game, and then for the Dream Team, we were able to change the world.
I plan on going on living for a long time, bugging you guys like I've always have. So you'll see me around. I plan on being with the Lakers in the league. Hopefully David will have me for a while."
I will say that I think it's the most important thing I've ever been involved with.
This epitomizes the difference between the NBA and most other leagues.
But I thought it was a real opportunity to stand by Magic and make a difference here. And it changed the face of AIDS and the discussion in this country and around the world. Really, it just shows you what the power of sports is.
Stern built a culture that saw players as partners, a culture current commissioner Adam Silver continues to nurture today, whereas such leagues as the NFL in particular has always treated these men like disposable assets. Now, the NBA has had its issues.
Visibility of seeing a black man at the White House in a dashiki shooting jump shots.
Okay. You know,
and having a doll to do it, I think.
The shunning of Craig Hodges after he asked President H.W. Bush to do more for the black community immediately comes to mind. However, the difference between them and, say, the NFL is that the NBA learned from its mistakes.
"I am banning Mr. Sterling for life from any association with the Clippers organization or the NBA.
And of course, we'll share it with the Redskins and others. But
Washington football team.
Excuse me, Washington football team. I apologize. That's a bad habit. But
it is the NFL with the long history of non-guaranteed contracts, allowing owners to dismiss players as if they never existed. It is the league that needed a rule to remind owners to interview minorities for head coaching jobs. It is the league that watched the president refer to its players as sons of bitches and largely took his side. When you view a player as your partner, you defend him. When you think of him as an asset, you defend what you believe is best for business.
I want to thank everybody up here, as well as my teammates, because they've been behind me all the way.
That's why when Magic was hurting, the NBA stood by his side regardless of the backlash.
I've been ready for 3 years. I've been denied for 3 years.
That's why when Colin Kaepernick was hurting, no team would go near him, and the NFL did nothing to support him.
We're waiting for the 32 owners, the 32 teams, Roger Goodell, all of them to stop running. Stop running from the truth. Stop running from the people.
Of course, the reality is not all backlashes can be avoided, and nor should they be. If history has taught us anything, it's that the world is not changed for the better by those who seek comfort over progress, or by leaders willing to accept injustices to avoid a confrontation.
We wish we had listened to our players earlier. That was, and we had a lot of players that were coming and bringing these issues to us, and it didn't start last summer. It started over 2 years ago, and we've been working with the Players Coalition over that period of time.
We are all in a season of much conflict right now. But the thing is, when you view players as partners, you know you face these conflicts together. But when you view players as assets, you are riddled with fear. Because at the end of the day, the conflict you fear most is the one within.
Our thanks to LZ Granderson for that perspective. We will be bringing you more of these history-making moments throughout the month. Start Here is produced by David Rhine, Kelly Therese, Josh Cohan, Lewis Millman, Ariel Chester, Tara Gimble, and the new mom on the staff, Lauren Efron. Thanks to Liz Alessi, Eric Johnson, Lakia Brown, John Newman, Elizabeth Russo, Abe Velez, and Stacia DeShishku. Special thanks this week to Kirit Radia, Cho Park, Cindy Galley, and big shout-out to Pete Madden, who reported out that story on the NFL for months. I'm Brad Milkey. See you Monday.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt cartridge.
What were you thinking that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia. Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.